Hebrews 6:7, the land that drinks in the rain often falling on it, and that produces a crop useful to those for whom it is farmed, receives a blessing from God. But land that produces thorns and thistles is worthless and is in danger of being cursed. In the end, it will be burned. Even though we speak like this, dear friends, we are confident of better things in your case, things that accompany salvation. God is not unjust. He will not forget your work, the love you have shown him as you have helped his people and continue to help them. We want each of you to show this same diligence to the very end in order to make your hope sure. We do not want you to become lazy, but to imitate those who through faith and patience inherit what has been promised. Today, I want to look at, last week we looked at that phrase, something better. Today, I want to look at the next phrase, things that accompany salvation. And I want to talk about three things today. We could talk about many things that accompany salvation, but I want to talk today about three things that accompany salvation and are the ground under which the writer of Hebrews has such hope in the people that he is writing to. How is it that in a fallen world where sin is so predominant, where the writer of Hebrews will go on and say, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily entangles us. How can he write, I have this great confidence because of the things that accompany salvation? Let me give you three things that I believe are the focus of his hope. Number one, the first thing that accompanies true salvation is an overcoming attitude. Those who are truly in Christ have an attitude of overcoming the enemy and the world. Look with me at Revelation 21, verse 7. Revelation 21, verse 7. We'll begin at verse 6. He said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To him who is thirsty, I will give to drink without cost from the spring of the water of life. He who overcomes will inherit all this, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, notice the contrast between the coward and the overcomer. The coward is the unbeliever. The overcomer is the one who perseveres in faith. God plants within those who are his an overcoming spirit. That's why throughout you go through the churches of Revelation, Revelation chapters 2, and 3. And what do you see? Over and over again. To him who overcomes 7 times, 7 churches. Now, not all the churches are condemned. Not all the churches are commended. But all the churches are told to him who overcomes. And so, we see that. Now, this is the operation of God's power. That's not something that I can say, wow, you know, I've become an overcomer. Look at me. This is not an operation of human endeavor. This is the power of God. Notice what Jesus says in Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10, verse 19. We'll begin in verse 18. Jesus is speaking, and it says, "He replied, I saw Satan fall like lightning from heaven." Jesus says, "I was there when he was cast out. I was there when he was thrown down. You don't have to tell me about Satan. I have given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions and to overcome all the power of the enemy. Nothing will harm you." Oh, does that mean that I'll never be persecuted? Not at all. Persecution will not harm me. Does that mean that I will never face torture? Perhaps not. But torture will not harm me. Does that mean I will not face death? No, I will face death. It is appointed unto men once to die, but death will not harm me. Because Jesus says, "I have given you authority." Jesus gives us that promise a second way in John chapter 16, where he talks of his own life. Look at John chapter 16. Verse 33. John 16, verse 33. Jesus has just been telling them about how bad things will become. He's told them that they will be persecuted, that they will be cast out of synagogues, that their friends will turn their back on them, that they will be ostracized. We think that's somehow strange. My friends turn their back on me, and we go, oh. Jesus says, "I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace." He's saying, I'm not sending you out without forewarning. It's going to happen, but in me you will have peace. Why? In this world you will have trouble, but take heart. I overcame the world. Jesus said, "I've set you the example. I've shown you it can be done. The world doesn't get the final verse." Do you understand that the world says you can't fight City Hall? You can't fight the man? They say, oh, to go out and try to do that is just tilting at windmills. Recalling Don Quixote and his mad attempt to be a knight. But Jesus says, "I did it. They killed me, but they didn't win. And they might kill you, but they won't win if you're in Him." Now, this is not the result of human power. This is not the result of a can-do attitude. This is not looking in the mirror every morning and saying, oh, you're going to succeed today. You're going to be good. This is not self-motivation. This is not listening to tapes. You are a good person. You will do well today. This is the power of God Himself. Look with me at 1 John. Look with me at 1 John. 1 John chapter 4. He's written about in the beginning of it. 1 John 1, "Dear friends, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they're from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world." He talks about in verse 3, the spirit of Antichrist that you have heard is coming and is now already in the world. And I can remember years ago I was at Pearl Street Baptist and I was greeting people at the door, and this woman and her daughter came up to me and they were standing in line, and Then I was shaking their hand, talking with them, and they said, "Oh, Pastor, a horrible thing has happened." I said, "What's that?" And the daughter, kind of half crying, said, "This new girl moved into school, and I became her friend, and we were really getting close, and I thought she was my friend, and then I learned she's a witch." I said, "Uh-huh." She said, "You don't understand. She's a witch, and she's going to curse me or something." I said, "Uh-huh." And the mother said, "You don't understand. She's a witch." I said, "No, you don't understand. Why are you coming in here sniveling to me? Why isn't she running home to her mother going, 'I've been practicing Wiccan, but I made a friend and they're a believer and I just know I'm going to get saved.'" People run around, "Oh, the Antichrist is coming." Look at verse 4. "You, dear children, are from God." Ooh, the Antichrist, he's from Satan. Big deal. And it is. But do we understand? "You, dear children, if you are truly saved, you are from God and have," past tense, "overcome them." Not "you will overcome them," "you might overcome them." There is a possibility if you do everything, you have overcome them. Because of your superior intellect, your disciplined behavior, your... No, because the one who is in you is greater than the one that is in the world. The writer of Hebrews says we can be confident of those things because the first thing that accompanies salvation is an overcoming attitude. And I see so many people that call themselves Christians and they're going, "Oh." Look at verse chapter 5, 1 John 5. Verse 4, "For preachers and missionaries and a few really dedicated believers." See, that's what the church in America would have you believe today. If you really want to live for Christ, they said, "Oh, you ought to be a missionary." You really want to live for Christ, they say, "Oh, are you a preacher?" "For everyone born of God overcomes the world." This is the victory that has overcome the world, even our faith. Who is that? Who is it that overcomes the world? Only he who believes that Jesus is the Son of God. We need to understand that God gives to those who are his an overcoming. And for us to live in fear, for us to withdraw from the battlefield and try to fortify, to hole up in our homes or our churches or our little circle of friends is anathema to the gospel. The second one is almost identical to the first, but it's enough different that I want to include it as something separate. Not only what accompanies salvation is an overcoming attitude, but we need to see where that overcoming attitude comes from. And it comes from this second thing, and that is that true believers are going through. Do you know where that, what I'm referring to when I talk about going through? Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. You know, I'm at that age today where some of you are not anywhere near, and some of you are here with me, and some of you have gone beyond that. But you know, you reach a certain age in life where everything's downhill. 10 years ago, I wasn't there. Today, I'm there. And I understand that 10 years from now, if the Lord tarries and if I survive, unfortunately, it'll be worse. And some of you are there. Some of you are that 10 years. And you can say, you know, it's the this pain and the that pain. And the, you know, the person that said aging is not for wimps knew what he was talking about. And until you face it personally, you don't understand that with the same zeal. I don't know how an unbeliever faces that. We were walking out from work Friday afternoon, my first day back after my toe incident. I was back at school, and we were walking down to, it's a long walk down from where we are to our cars, and one of them that was walking down brought up about how the people that died, and they see a light, and they were talking back and forth about that. I said, well, you know, that is not exactly true. They said, what do you mean? I said, well, a study was done on that, and most of the people that interview with these books, they interview people months or years after their near-death experience, and all of them report the same thing. They saw light, they felt at peace, blah, 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 blah. But that is not true, and there was a researcher that did a study where he talked with people who had a near-death experience within a week to 2 weeks of the event. He interviewed them actually in the hospital where they had come back from having a near-death experience. He found that the vast majority of them, instead of talking about a light and feeling at peace, talked about being in agony and feeling a weight pressing down upon them and seeing darkness and being terrified. But those same people, months later, had repressed those memories and talked about seeing a light and feeling wonderful. And the one person said, well, boy, I don't even want to think about that. I said, why not? If it's reality, wouldn't you want to think about it so that you can start to think about how you can escape that? Well, I just hope that it'll all work out. I don't know how you age with that kind of hope. High in the sky, well, maybe, hopefully, gee, I don't know. I don't have a clue, but I hope. I'm only in my 50s. I don't know how you be in your 70s or your 80s. I don't know how you face being in a nursing home and saying, boy, that's what I have to look forward to. You see, overcoming is directly related to how much you are focused on the end of the race. I don't know if any of you have ever run long-distance races. I'm not talking about, you know, running across the yard to catch your kid. I'm talking where you go out and run 10, 15, 20 miles at a time. And if you've never done that, there is a point, and runners talk about that. They talk about runner's euphoria. There's a point where when you're running, the endorphins in your brain start to kick in, and you don't feel pain, and you feel this natural high and you feel uplifted, but your body can't produce endorphins forever. And after you've run so many miles, your brain runs out of endorphins to inject into the brain, and that stops, and all of a sudden that pounding on your knees and that pounding on your hip and that pounding on your back and the fatigue in your shoulders from keeping your arms up starts to set in, and you start to get sore. And if you go the real long distances, like the marathons or the super marathons, you reach the point where you just run out of everything in your body to burn. I don't care how much you carb loaded the night before, you ate pasta till it ran out your ears, which is what marathoners do. You reach a point where everything in your stomach has been consumed, and then your body begins to break down your muscles. And everything in your body is saying, stop, stop, stop. And there's only one thing that keeps that distance runner going, and that is knowing what comes at the end. And that's why the Apostle Paul, you say, now why? Because we have to understand, that's why the Apostle Paul says in 2 Corinthians, look at 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Now remember what he's talked about in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. He's talked about verse 8. We are hard pressed on every side, but not crushed, perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not struck down. We're always carrying about in our body the death of Jesus. He says, I've reached that point in the race where it hurts. I can remember when I was a young Christian, and it was exciting to be persecuted. I'm not so sure that at my age it's exciting anymore. But what keeps you going? Look at verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart. How many people do you know that are losing heart today? Now, with the unsaved, that's perfectly natural. I can't have a clue as to why they don't lose heart. What do they have to look forward to? Oh, it's easy to be unsaved and be 20. We have a girl in my class that's just turning 30, just inching up on 30. And it's starting to dawn on her that the 30s aren't going to be the 20s. And she doesn't have a clue as to what lays beyond that. But the bottom line is, I can see why they lose heart. Because though outwardly we are wasting away, and we are. You reach a point in your life, and many of you, the majority of us, are at that point. There's only a handful of us here that are not at that point where you've reached the point where, you know, you don't grow up anymore, you start to grow out. You know, they always ask you when you were a kid, what are you going to do when you grow up? They should have asked you, what are you going to do when you grow out? He says, yet inwardly, we are being renewed day by day. How? For our light and momentary troubles are achieving. Now think about what he means by light and momentary troubles. Anybody here been beaten so badly that they thought you were dead? Me neither. He did. 3 times. Plus they stoned him. And you know, This never hit me till I grew up, till I grew older. This never hit me when I was a new Christian in my teens. Because, you know, I was used to flopping down motorcycles and hurting things and it healing up and, you know, a few months later. But, you know, it's the aggregate of all those things. And all of a sudden you hit your 40s and your 50s and your 60s and all those things, stupid things you did when you were 15 come back to haunt you. And you feel the weather, you know, in the bones that you broke and in the joints that you tore. And when you go out in the winter and the cold, it sinks in a way that it never did. Think about that for the Apostle Paul. I'm not asking you to think about actually being beaten with her. I'm asking you to think about 5 years later after he's been beaten with rods five times. All those bones that broke and didn't set exactly right. It's not like he could go to an X-ray machine. Those times that he was stoned, do you realize how stoning kills a person? Do you know how you die in stoning? You actually die in stoning from drowning. Do you understand that? When you stone a person, they die from drowning. Because the stones impact the chest, break the ribs puncture the lungs, the blood flows into the lungs, and you drowned in your own blood. Think about the residual of those, all those broken bones. And Paul says these light and momentary troubles. And you know, we get upset because we can't buy a new this or get a new that or go on a vacation or... Where did Paul get that perspective of going through? Or achieving in us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes. You see, that's a runner's term. That's what runners do. They fix their eyes on the goal. I love this old movie from years ago. It's about a street race. And the guy gets in his car. And he goes, "The first rule of Italian driving." And he grabs onto the mirror and rips it off of the windshield. Throws it over his shoulder. What's behind me does not matter. Doesn't that sound like Paul in Philippians? Forgetting those things which are behind, I press on to the goal. Doesn't that sound exactly like that? While we fix our eyes on not on what is seen, but as what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. The third thing. What accompanies salvation? An overcoming attitude. That attitude of going through. Not going into. Not stopping in the middle of. Not, I'm going through. I may not win today. I may not win tomorrow. I may not win the next day. I may not win one time for the next 20 years. You know, there's people in the scriptures that did that, didn't they? There's guys that never won once in this life in the scriptures. Look at Jeremiah. The writer of Hebrews talks about them when he says at the end, after the ones that had victories, he says, "And what about the ones that were eaten by lions and destroyed by this and killed this way?" And there's guys that, according to the world, never won. They went into the fire, and there wasn't a fourth man in there with them. And they didn't walk out with their hair unsinged. But they still won. They still won. The third thing is, a real heart change. And this is what is so often missing in contemporary Christianity. Salvation is not just a standing change. It's not just, okay, God, you forgave me from all my sins. Woo-ah! Freedom to do whatever I want. It is a genuine heart change. And the writer of Hebrews dwells on that. Look with me at Hebrews. How can he have such confidence? Because he knows what it means to have a genuine heart change. Look at Hebrews chapter 8. Hebrews chapter 8. He's been talking about how Jesus has a new covenant. And we use that to disparage the Old Testament, and some people ignore the Old Testament. But that's not the point. The point is we should have more than them, not disparage what they have. We shouldn't be looking at them and going, oh, we don't need to live up to that. We should be going, wow, what low standards. It would be like being a college senior and being handed a kindergartner's test and going, are you kidding me? This is the test? Hebrews 8, 7, for if there had been nothing wrong with that first covenant, no place would have been sought for another. If the law of Moses would have worked, there would have been no reason to do something else, right? Right? But God found fault with the people and said, the time is coming, declares the Lord. And guess what? When that was written in the Old Testament, he was looking forward. But are we looking forward to that time anymore? No. He was talking about us. All that stuff that was promised, we've got it. The time is coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah. It will not be like the covenant I made with their forefathers when I took them by the hand and led them out of Egypt, because they did not remain faithful to my covenant. Read through the Old Testament. How many end well? Not very many. Read through the New Testament. How many end well? And the fact is, most. Did Peter end well? How about John? Did he end well? How about James? Did he end well? All three of them. How about Paul? Did he end well? How about Timothy? Did he end well? And we can go on and on. And turned away, and I turned away from them, declares the Lord. This is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after that time, declares the Lord. I will put my law in their minds, and I will write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. And no longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, know the Lord. No longer will I have to go, oh, I know the law, but I don't know the Lord. To be a part of God's people is to very much know the Lord. It's the only way to become one. Unless a man is born again. Because they will all know me. Does that mean we don't need teachers? Not at all. But it means fundamentally the one thing that matters. You can be taught in church for 1,000 years and not know anything. I knew people in seminary that had more letters in the after their name than they had in their name. But you know what? Doesn't matter how much you could parse the Greek and the Hebrew, and you could tell that this verse meant exactly this. I knew men that knew all kinds of facts, but they didn't know the Lord. And I've known people who can barely read, who couldn't construct an English sentence if they were asked to do it by an English teacher, write down the past participle of, they'd look at you and go, the what of the who? For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more. Look with me. He doesn't stop there. Look with me over at Hebrews 10. Hebrews 10. Verse 14. Hebrews 10, verse 14. He comes back to this very same verse. And here's what he says. Hebrews 10, 14. Because by one sacrifice, he, Jesus, has made perfect forever those who are being made holy. Now, do you catch that? Do you catch the change there? It's not because by one sacrifice he will make perfect those who are being made holy. That would make sense. He's making them holy, and in the future they'll be made perfect. See, that would make sense, wouldn't it? But that's not what it says, is it? It says, because by one sacrifice he has made perfect, past tense, those who are being, present tense, made holy. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? You see, perfection comes from the blood of Christ. But that blood isn't some theoretical thing that just washes off theoretical marks on a theoretical book in a theoretical heaven someplace. It is a blood that washes away sin. Not just sin on God's ledger book, but sin in my heart. Sin in my life. Sin in my mouth. Sin in my mind. And having been plunged under the blood of Christ, having been washed in that sacrifice, and having been made perfect, now, as that blood flows into every part of a life, I am being made holy. And you see, the writer of Hebrews says, that's inevitable. It is inevitable that that will happen. If it doesn't happen, there is something radically wrong. That's why he ends this chapter with, chapter 10, but we are not of those who shrink back, 10:39. Because he knew that those who have been made perfect are being made holy today. He says, we are not of those who shrink back. Watch out for those who shrink back. We're not of those. But of those who believe and are saved. Oh, what hope there is in that powerful gospel. That something better that has the things that accompany salvation. It is time that the whole gospel was preached and the whole gospel was believed. And most importantly, the whole gospel was demonstrated to a world that sees no difference between itself and those who claim to believe. Let's bow together. Lord, you have given us awesome promises in your word. Promises that are far beyond anything that most people who in America name your name today even comprehend. Far beyond an hour a day or sitting in a church or carrying a Bible or reading a daily devotion. Promises about a new attitude, a new mind, a new way of looking at things, a new direction for our eyes, and a new heart inside. And because those things are real in those who believe, your word can offer great hope. Oh Lord, may we be the recipients of that great hope. To the glory and honor and praise of King Jesus.